This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to Dr. Sanjay Gupta about his change of heart on medical marijuana.
First, we want to hear from you on what home means to you. You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
We're inspired by an interview we did yesterday. Author Sally Ohms talked to people around the country about the concept of home, how it can be changed by old age, disaster, moving around the country, and more. And we want to hear your experience.
Are you getting ready to move away from home or go to college? Are you sending your kid off to school? And how does that change your idea of home now?
Or are you new to Wisconsin or just moved back? Does it feel like home to you? Call at 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
We've got a call already. Mariama in Alma Center. Hi, Mariama.
Hi.
So what's your...
Hello?
Yeah. What does home mean to you?
Home is where my family is. I'm actually going off to college, but I think home will always be where my parents are in Wisconsin.
Where are you going to college, if I may ask?
Durham University.
Okay.
It's in the UK.
Wow. Oh, so you're going a long way.
Yeah.
So you're not going to be able to run home and do your laundry.
No, that'll be slightly inconvenient, but I'll manage.
Okay. Well, how do you think you're going to recreate your sense of home when you go to college, you know, across an ocean?
I think food and cooking the way my mom has taught me to cook, and also just keeping in touch with family. Although it'll never be the same, I can try to make it more comfortable.
And Mariama, I imagine that while you're away, a lot's going to change at home as, you know, as everything changes. Do you think, do you expect things to be the same? Or, you know, what if your parents even moved to a different town? Would it still feel like home even in a new place?
I think so, because we're pretty adaptable. We've moved quite a bit, so
we've
found a way to make home wherever it is.
And what if they move but don't tell you? I just Mariama, good luck with this big move, and thanks for sharing what you think home means to you. Now, how about you? 800-642-1234 if you're making a move like Mariama is, or if you or an elderly relative grappled with the decision to stay at home, move into a facility, move in with relatives. Anything that shakes up your idea of what home is, you can join us now at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And our email address, too, is talk@WPR.org. Maybe you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We got an email from Roxanne in Madison. She says, home to me is a place I have my pictures up. In every apartment I've occupied, I put up a wall of pictures of my family and favorite people. That makes it feel like my own little nest.
That's great. Nice. That's great. And that's kind of what we're looking for here. Is home one fixed place for you? Or can it move? Can you take the pictures along like Roxanne did? Cook like Mariama did, those familiar recipes. And while we've got some calls coming in now, I'll just say this is from before the start of the show. I wanted to do segments like this. I know you have a lot of stories to tell and to share with us. And we want to do this, set aside time from time to time so you can share your experiences, your thoughts on matters big and small. Brian is with us next in West Allis. Brian, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I am what's called a burner. I attend a festival in Nevada called Burning Man. Almost every year I can. I've been out there 6 times now. And one of the really awesome things about this place is, especially if you're a first-timer, which we call a virgin, everyone says, welcome home. This is a huge gathering of people from all over the world. They're mostly the fringes of society getting together for common cause of getting rid of the normal little stuff that we deal with. No money is allowed. There's no boundaries. You can climb on anything. You can do almost whatever you want.
Brian, I want to ask. I want to ask, sure. You said they said welcome home. It's people from the fringe of society. Do you feel like you or a lot of the people there maybe don't feel at home in their daily lives, and this is where they go to feel at home?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's kind of the point, is when you're kind of one of the weirdos, when you're one of the guys that walks around in purple toe shoes and engages in activities that most of society finds a little bit bizarre. When you're surrounded by 60,000, is the cap this year, when you're surrounded by 60,000 other weirdos, you aren't weird anymore. You're just part of the crowd.
All right.
Well, and that amazing feeling of having 20 people come up to you that you've never met before and say, welcome home, is probably one of the coolest sensations I've ever had in my life.
All right. Well, Brian, I'm glad you found that home. Thanks a lot for sharing your story.
We'll go next to Tori in Green Bay. Hi, Tori.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What does home mean to you?
Well, I've grown up in Wisconsin, so Wisconsin's always going to be my home because that's where my memories are. But I've traveled a lot, and when I travel, I like to bring my special books and a couple of the pieces of art that I always hang up first to make it feel homey. And right now, I live part of the time in Mexico with my family, and I have two young children. And every time we come back to Wisconsin, I don't say we're going home. I say we're going back to Wisconsin because my young children see Mexico as their home. So it's wherever our family is together, and it's wherever we're making memories, like it is for me in Wisconsin.
Nice.
And I also want to say that home is where my friends are. I've always made friends no matter where I live, and that's what else makes me feel like it's like my family away from home is my group of friends.
Well, thank you so much, Tori. That's great.
We'll go now to Adele in Cudahy. Adele, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been living I grew up in Wisconsin, but when I was 21, I went to Michigan and had my four children there. And they're now, my four children are in four different time zones and none near me. And so now I moved back to Wisconsin for a job, but I find that my heart is still in Michigan and I'm planning to move back there. But one thing I always took with me, no matter where I went, I once went to school for 10 weeks in southern Washington, and I took along a rainbow, little jars of color, and I would always put them in a windowsill, and I always took them with me. So I find that wherever you are, that you can make it home, even if you're by yourself.
Hmm. All right. Well, thanks. And you've got that rainbow up in the window still?
I do. I'm in Cudahy right now, and I have it up in the window.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you so much, Adele, for sharing your story.
An anonymous introvert says, home is where introverts go to recharge. Yeah.
Well, I kind of like that. Yeah, I feel that, definitely. We've got a caller. We didn't get the city name yet, but Mike is on the line with us. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? I live up now currently in St. Germain, Wisconsin. Originally was from the suburbs of Illinois, of Chicago. And, you know, I really believe home is where the heart is. And I was in a relationship that really wasn't a good relationship down in Illinois. And, you know, we got divorced and, you know, it just never felt like a comfortable place, let's say, because of the difficulties. I moved into an apartment for about 14 months nearby, and again, I just didn't feel like that was really, you know, the place for me. It just felt like a stepping stone. Well, I had moved up to St. Germain, where I had owned a cabin since the early 90s, and I've always had a passion for the North Woods, the outdoors, and just the beautiful scenery. And I've lived there since about 16 months, and I really feel that that is where my heart is and where my home is. And when I have my family, my kids, you know, friends come up and visit me, they just feel a peacefulness, a serenity that is infectious. And to me, that's where home is.
Mike, thank you so much. I'm glad you found your home in the North Woods.
And thank you all for your calls today. You can keep sharing your stories on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll talk to Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent, about his change of mind on medicinal marijuana. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
Coming up, according to new reporting on NSA surveillance, rules weren't just bent, they were broken.
First, we're talking to Dr. Sanjay Gupta about medical marijuana. Back in 2009, he wrote a piece for Time magazine called Why I Would Vote No on Pot.
But he's just come out and reversed his decision on medical marijuana, in part because of his research on a documentary for CNN called Weed. He took a closer look, and he's here today to tell us why he changed his mind. Dr. Sanjay Gupta is chief medical correspondent for CNN and a practicing neurosurgeon. Dr. Gupta, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, let's go back in time to that article you wrote called Why I Would Vote No on Pot. What then led you to come to that conclusion?
Well, I think, you know, as physicians, when you're thinking about a new medicine, you want to ask yourself several questions. You want to ask, is this something that is safe? Is it effective? Is it more effective than what's already out there? And, I think it was at that time when I looked at the literature, really hard to make the case that there was a real role at that time for medicinal marijuana. I thought that a lot of the particular disorders or diseases could be treated with existing medications. Since then, I sort of realized a couple of things. One is that if you look at the literature in the United States, you'll find lots of papers on medical marijuana, but you come to find that it's a bit of a distorted picture because so many of the studies are designed to look for harm. They're designed to look for harm. So the question that they're asking is about harm. And about 95-94% of the papers that I found really were sort of looking at that particular issue, and only about 5 or 6% looking at the benefits. And that was sort of a distorted view. When I started to leave the country and look at literature in other places, visit other labs, look at the science going on around the world, my views started to change. And then when I met patients, lots of them, not just anecdotal stories, but lots and lots of patients who had legitimate problems and were being legitimately helped by marijuana when nothing else worked, I think that, you know, that really swayed me.
Is it hard to do good research in the United States given the climate and the laws related to drugs in this country?
I think the researchers would answer yes to that question, and there's a couple of reasons. First of all, you're dealing with a substance that is federally illegal, so that right away just makes it challenging. If you're going to be doing a research project, looking at marijuana and cancer, for example, you would get approval from the National Cancer Institute, but then you'd also need approval from the National Institute on Drug Abuse to actually obtain the marijuana for study. Again, we're talking about a federally illegal substance. And the National Institute on Drug Abuse has to authorize that, and inherent in their title is their mission. They're looking at drug abuse. So their mission is to study the harms, the perils, the problems with marijuana, and I think that makes it more challenging for a researcher to look at potential benefits.
Where do you see potential for benefits for use of marijuana in medicine?
Well, I mean, I think there's, again, if you look around the world, there's all sorts of different studies that have already been done looking at everything from very specific pain disorders like neuropathic pain to convulsive disorders, you know, profound seizures, refractory seizures that are very hard to treat. You know, there's some really interesting research going on right now regarding things like PTSD, regarding Parkinson's disease, and even looking at marijuana as a potential protectant to the brain, something that can help protect the brain after either head injury or stroke. And this is ongoing. With regard to cancer, for example, there are 3 trials going on around the world, one in Israel, one in Spain, and one in San Francisco. So it is starting to happen, and we're starting to see some of the fruit of that research.
When you're talking about cancer, you're not talking about marijuana as something that would be a cure for cancer itself, but a palliative care, if that's the right word, something to treat symptoms?
Well, marijuana is used right now to treat some of the side effects of the treatments for cancer, such as nausea from chemotherapy or emaciation. But what the researchers are looking at specifically now is the impact of marijuana on cancer cells.
Really?
It's very early. Yeah, it's very early research. It's still in animals in Israel and in Spain, but this idea that there is some sort of toxic potential for marijuana against cancer cells, I think, is something that, you know, they've really started to look into. It's not conclusive by any means yet, but you do have these types of trials going on now around the world.
Marijuana isn't harmless, though. There are side effects, aren't there, that we should worry about?
Yeah, no doubt. And I think, you know, in particular, in people's whose brains are still developing, and, you know, that really is up into age 25, if you look at the neuroscience, I think it has a greater impact, a greater detrimental impact on those brains. If you think of the brain sort of as these cities made up of gray matter and highways made up of white matter, it appears to have an impact more on the white matter, so the roads or the highways connecting the various cities. And, you know, so that's of, you know, obvious concern. And you know, when you look at a lot of the existing, trials that are going on, they certainly think about that as well. And I think about that as a father myself. But the real thing that's being studied here is looking at this as a potential medicine. And if you start to look at harms of different medicines for these potential problems, it becomes more apparent as to the potential of marijuana. I'll tell you, you know, you talk about pain, for example. In this country, we use a lot of narcotic pain medication. 80% of the world's narcotics are used in the United States. And we know that every 19 minutes, someone dies of an accidental prescription drug overdose. So now if you add that fact into what I told you earlier, you have marijuana, which could potentially treat pain. It could potentially treat pain when other things don't work. And from a macro level, I couldn't find any documented cases of people dying from marijuana overdose. So from a macro level, it may have a greater safety profile. So yes, there's always concerns, and there should be, and those need to be studied. But I think, you know, you have to take it all in context.
So those drugs you mentioned that people die of overdose, they're Schedule 2, I think, meaning they're the kind of drugs that people rob pharmacies to get. Marijuana, is it an even more dangerous level of classification, Schedule 1? Why is it considered in that rating system such a dangerous drug?
I don't know. It's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. And, you know, I've spent a long time looking into this. I will tell you that a Schedule 1 drug puts it in the category of most dangerous substances in the United States. It puts it in the category of the highest abuse potential, and it puts it in the category of having no medical applications. And I don't think any of those things are true when you really start to look at the science. And, in fact, if you look at the letter back in 1970 that was written to basically declare this a Schedule 1 substance, the letter basically said, because of a void in our knowledge regarding this plant, we are going to classify this as Schedule 1 and wait for more studies to be done. So it wasn't so much because of studies proving those criteria, it was because of an absence of science. And, you know, not many things work that way, but in the case of marijuana, that is a stunning fact as to why it was classified as Schedule 1.
Dr. Gupta, you're a big name. You saying this has made a big splash. What has been the response from your colleagues in the medical community to what you've said about medical marijuana?
Well, you know, it's hard to paint the entire medical community with one broad brushstroke. I think, you know, for the most part, the feedback I've received has been pretty positive. I mean, I think, you know, at our core, most doctors and people in the medical world are scientists. That we like to look at data. We don't like to deal in the world of anecdotal knowledge, of conjecture, of hyperbole. So I think, you know, just simply laying out the science from the United States and around the world, and being able to chart the history of the science over the last, you know, 70 to 100 years, I think has been important for a lot of my colleagues to hear. And that's what I'm hearing. I've gotten so many emails from doctors, but also from people who are legislators and people who are even members of the church. I mean, I think this is a real societal issue. I'm hearing about it from just about every facet of our society, patients and parents of patients, and it's been quite remarkable in that regard.
We're seeing state laws change around the country. Do you think, say, within a decade, we'll see legal medical marijuana at the federal level?
It's so hard to predict. You know, I mean, there's a lot about the medical marijuana laws at the federal level that I don't think make much sense. So so it's hard for me to say that it's suddenly going to make sense in a decade from now. I don't know. I think the fact that the United States government, through its Department of Health and Human Services, has a patent on marijuana as a medical therapeutic for neuroprotection, while at the same time they say it has no medical applications, that doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, that, you know, I think journalists are trained to hate hypocrisy. That is hypocrisy. And so because of that, because of some of the, frankly, illogical things surrounding marijuana, it's hard for me to predict what the future holds.
Dr. Gupta, thank you so much for joining us today.
You got it. Anytime. Thank you.
That was Dr. Sanjay Gupta, chief medical correspondent for CNN and a practicing neurosurgeon.
Coming up next, we'll talk to a blogger about news today that the NSA broke privacy rules thousands of times since 2008. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get advice on pickling all those cucumbers and other produce showing up this month.
But first, the Washington Post reports that the National Security Agency, or NSA, broke privacy rules thousands of times a year since being granted broader powers in 2008. This information comes from a review of top-secret documents leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
According to the report, these breaches range from significant law violations to typographical errors that resulted in unintended interceptions of emails and phone calls.
Joining us to discuss this news is Quinn Norton, a blogger and journalist whose work has been published in Wired, The Atlantic, and other publications. Quinn, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, to be clear, these top-secret documents are internal audit reports of the NSA, correct?
Yes.
So tell us briefly about what kinds of infractions were found in those documents.
Well, a lot of what we're seeing in those documents are over-collection or improper collection. For instance, one of the typographic ones was putting in the D.C. area code instead of the country code for Egypt. And intercepting a bunch of phone calls that way. I actually think that we don't know quite the shape of a lot of these things or the extent, because we're not looking at any kind of rigorous oversight system. This is just, I feel like the door has cracked, and we're kind of seeing that thin glimpse into the room via this internal audit report.
Mm. So what does it say about the Obama administration's reassurances earlier this month that the NSA's electronic surveillance programs are tightly regulated?
I mean, he said on Friday Friday last week, mm-hmm. That he was comfortable that there was no abuse. And I think that just to put straight out there what that was a lie. And given the timeline of when they were responding to Barton Gelman's article, they probably, can't say for sure, but probably had already known that this was coming out, which makes it, to my mind, not only a lie, but a kind of tactically questionable one. I don't really understand the administration's thinking on immediately saying there's no abuse of the system right before a big news report about all the thousands of abuses in the system coming out.
Well, one of the issues was that these documents showed more detail and analysis than what was actually shared with the Justice Department. So, in other words, the
yes.
NSA, it doesn't sound like the NSA reported all of these details the same way they did others. So do you think that this information ever would have come to light if Edward Snowden hadn't have leaked these documents to The Washington Post?
No, I don't see how they could have.
And do you have any, I guess, would you speculate on as to why they didn't report these errors?
Well, the court has already said that they don't actually have much in the way of ability to enforce their oversight. They don't have an, the court does not have an investigative body that goes in and audits the NSA. They're entirely relying on self-report. And I think what you see in any kind of large organization with many employees is that eventually, you know, you're kind of ducking the oversight because the oversight's time consuming. You could get in trouble. It's a very human instinct to just kind of, you know, duck the class monitor.
Well, I imagine that if you think, say that this was an honest mistake, I didn't mean to punch in the country or the area code for Washington, D.C., but rather the country code for Egypt. Whoops, it was an honest mistake. Could that have been a reason why this information wasn't shared?
Well, certainly incidental collection is not part of this data set. That is not considered like things that are accidentally swept in and the metadata. Things accidentally swept in and not really looked at by an analyst and the metadata, that's not part of this. That's not considered problematic in this way. The other thing that's absent in this report is, as near as we can tell looking at it, is any intentional abuse. This is all mistakes. So whether or not the mistakes are kind of entering into the realm of like a Fourth Amendment violation or if they're just considered operational mistakes that don't actually violate any laws, that latter category is not in this. The former category is, but there's no indication of intentional abuse. And I find that particularly troubling because in any organization, it's very large, whether it's Microsoft or Google or certainly government agencies, there's always a few people who go off the reservation. They do something, they stalk their ex-girlfriend, whatever. And there's usually some sort of oversight and disciplinary measure, but you just have that problem in large organizations. The fact that that isn't here at all just makes me think we haven't seen those numbers yet.
So what kind of oversight systems are in place to find that kind of abuse if it exists, and what would be done about it?
Well, the NSA has said that they have over 300 people working on this problem. But they haven't told us anything about how they're working on this problem. And they're also working on it with an interpretation of the law that is still classified. So whether or not they consider what they consider illegal or legal is not known to us. The procedures that those 300 people are following to find intentional and unintentional abuse are not known to us. We just have this one little bit. And in that little bit, we have thousands of violations. It's a troubling situation to be in.
So if these abuses have been allegedly taking place since 2008, can we speculate that that there might have been more prior to that? And how would we ever find out for sure?
Well, certainly, you know, there's been some whistleblowing about Stellar Wind, which was the mass collection before 2008. We don't know anything about the oversight system that was on Stellar Wind, if there was any. They were ready to roll out mass surveillance before, according to the whistleblowers Drake and Binney. They actually had a lot of this infrastructure in place before September 11th, and they were ready to roll out domestic surveillance basically the day that it happened. And I think one of the things that's important to bear in mind is that if you've got an agency that's information collectors, that's people who like to collect information, and they're going to over-collect if they get the chance because it's what they're good at. And that's why oversight and transparency are so important in these systems. But we don't really have any functional oversight. If the body that is supposed to be overseeing the NSA, and that body has existed, the FISA court has existed since the 1970s, has nothing but self-report, then it doesn't seem to me that we have any assurance that there has been good oversight even before these problems in 2008. There's got to be more reports somewhere, but we don't have access to them.
Well, lawmakers are already calling for reforms today and for greater transparency in NSA operations. Do you think that this could be a turning point in accountability?
Well, one of the things, I mean, you know, Obama made it clear in his August 9th press conference that he had no intention of calling for or cooperating with efforts to stop mass collection, to stop the collection of Americans' phone data, these sorts of things, just to try and get Americans to be more comfortable with it. And at that point, as I say, I think there's a good chance that they already knew that that this Washington Post piece was on the way. So I think that the executive is digging its heels in. I don't know what it takes to be a turning point. The executive has a lot of power in this situation. Obama, the DOJ, the military, they've all got a very entrenched infrastructure. And I think it might call for a revolt from Congress to upset that Congress may not at this point be politically capable of.
So you've been following this story closely. In just a minute or so, what additional insights do you have to share about this issue?
This the thing that I always go on about is that we do have some power as individuals by using encrypted communication. Using encrypted communication does mean that the NSA keeps our communications actually indefinitely compared to having to destroy them if we are known American persons. But it does mean that if they want to dig into the mass communications of people, they have to put a lot of money and a lot of people and a lot of computers on doing it. And I think making our privacy more expensive is something that everyone in America can actually push towards doing right now. So I just encourage people to respond to this news by securing their own information and thinking about their own privacy and learning about encryption tools.
Well, thank you for being with us, Quinn.
Thank you for having me.
That was Quinn Norton, a journalist whose work has been published in Wired, The Atlantic, and other publications. She joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco.
Coming up next, We Can Pickle That. We'll speak with Jennifer McKenzie, author of The Complete Book of Pickling, about what to do with all our produce. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This time of year, there's an abundance of cucumbers at farmers markets and in gardens around Wisconsin.
One way to keep up with the cucumber storm is to make pickles. Here to explain the process is Jennifer McKenzie, professional home economist and author of The Complete Book of Pickling, 250 recipes from pickles and relishes to chutneys and salsas. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
All right, so what's the basic pickle? We take our cucumber and do what to it?
Well, you need to add vinegar. That's what pickling's all about. And anything that is lower in acid, like a cucumber, in order to preserve it, you need to add vinegar. So there's all different formulations. Some of them have sugar. Some of them have spices. And then, of course, there's the classic dill pickle. And, so basically you need a balanced recipe. So you don't want it too vinegary so that you can't eat it. But you need enough vinegar to make sure you're preserving it.
So why do you soak the cucumbers in salt before you put them in the pickling liquid?
Well, some techniques that use that technique. And what you're doing, you're drawing out the natural water from the cucumber, so you're getting rid of that. The salt draws that out, and then that way you can get more of the wonderful pickling brine that you've made with your vinegar and your sugar and your seasonings that goes right into the cucumber. So you're essentially exchanging the liquid in the cells of the cucumber, and that helps to preserve them, and it helps to flavor them, all that delicious pickle flavor.
And do you need to heat those guys?
Yes. Definitely, I always recommend doing the hot water bath. So once you've filled your jars, you use a hot pickling liquid. Sometimes you pack the cucumbers in cold. Sometimes you heat them up. But you add the hot pickling liquid in your hot jars, and then you immerse them in a boiling water canner. So everybody's seen those big canners with the racks in them and then those two-piece lids. And that's what I call insurance. And I know there's lots of grandmas out there who have never done the boiling water canner, but it creates a vacuum seal, so you don't get any thing going into the jar you don't want, and it also destroys any microorganisms that might be in the jar, and then it preserves them so that you can have wonderful, delicious pickles that won't go bad on the shelf.
So what kind of spices are we adding to it to get the flavors that we want? What would you recommend?
Well, dill is obviously a classic, and I don't know about your gardens, but the gardens right now, the dill heads are those big flowers, and you can use the dill seeds and the feathery fronds from the dill, and that adds a very classic flavor. I like to add sometimes some mustard seeds or garlic for sure in some of the dill pickles. And then if you're talking about bread and butter pickles, one of my favorite combinations is a bit of sugar. They're a little bit sweeter. Some mustard seeds, celery seeds, and a tiny bit of curry powder, and that's what I think makes a perfect bread and butter pickle.
I used to do a fair amount of canning. I haven't lately. My one biggest failure is when I tried to make pickles, I used this random spice mix that obviously wasn't intended for cucumber pickles, it turned out. And two, they were mushy. And they were just like really, you know, mouthfeel if you're a wine person. It just was all wrong, man. What did I do wrong? What makes for a mushy pickle?
Well, sometimes it was the cucumber's fault. It wasn't your fault at all. Sometimes if a cucumber is drying out or it's kind of, you know, sometimes they get that punky texture just if the growing season wasn't good or if they were picked too long. You want to get your cucumbers either from the farmer's market or from the farm or from your garden and pickle them as soon as possible after harvesting, because if they tend to, if they start to dry out, they're sort of punky and they get that mushy texture, and also if the vinegar balance isn't correct. So some people added alum or grape leaves or something to keep them crispy, but I find if you just have the right balance of vinegar, so use a tested recipe and use your really fresh cucumbers. And one of the ways to check your cucumbers, if they're the right texture, put them in a big sink of water, and if they float, they're too dry and they won't make good pickles. You want them to be heavy and sink.
Well, I like blame the pickles, or blame the cucumber.
Blame the cucumbers.
That's a good motto. So how long does it take to pickle something? Is this an all-day project or just a couple hours?
It all depends. Sometimes some of them are really quick. There's my classic quick dill pickles, and those ones you just heat up the vinegar, sugar, water, and the dill, and then you put the cucumbers into the jars cold. So those ones you just pack them into the jars, you pour in the hot liquid, and then they're only in the canner for about 15 minutes. So you could certainly do it in the morning. Some of them are sort of over 2 days, the ones that you soak with the salt. Either they're sliced ones or whole, and you soak them overnight with the salt, and that draws out the water, and then the next day, but it's certainly not two full days of work by any means. And then there's other ones, if you're going to ferment them, then you have them, you know, down in your cellar for, you know, a couple of weeks, and those are a little more time consuming, but you can get a nice batch of pickles or two in a half a day.
Now, you send us a recipe. We've got it up on the Central Time Facebook page. Dill pickles they're cut into chips, like for sandwiches. What's the idea behind the recipe? Anything else special about that one?
Well, you know, I love my bread and butter pickles, and I don't think that you can have a grilled cheese sandwich without the bread and butters. And those are a sort of a sweeter style, but a lot of people just love their dill cucumbers. And one of the things I found with this recipe, when you get the dill pickles and you want to make the little baby dills and with the whole pickles, if you've got some that are a little bit too big, you only get three or four in a jar, and that seems to be a bit of a waste of time. So if you slice them up into thin slices, either lengthwise or crosswise, and then make these dilly pickles, cucumber chips, you can pack a lot more in the jar. You can use up those slightly bigger cucumbers, and they're already pre-sliced for your sandwiches and burgers. So they're like the style of a bread and butter pickle by the looks of them, but they still have that lovely dill flavor.
Well, now I, for one, have a small kitchen and old appliances, electric appliances. So when I hear about canning, the first thing I think is, this is not for me. I can't do it. Can you give me and others with small kitchens and old appliances a pep talk?
Well, and you know what's so funny? I have the smallest kitchen. Even for what I do, people walk in, they're like, really? This is your kitchen? I have it. It's efficient, I call it. And you know what? If you can bring a pot of water to boil on your stove, so as long as it functions that well and you can bring a pot of water to boil, it doesn't matter. You don't have to have the fancy appliances. I do have a big canning pot because you do need a pot that the jars fit in with an inch or two of water above them. So you need a deep pot, but you don't have to buy a fancy canner or anything. And they're actually really economical because they're not even as good as sort of my regular cooking pots. They're just a thinner but a big kettle. But you can just use a deep pot, and if you use the shorter jars, like the pint jars, your pot doesn't even have to be too deep. So you can use regular equipment. I really do like my canning equipment that I have the special funnel and I have the tongs, but you can get those sort of at hardware stores and home stores really economically just if you're going to be doing any canning. And then, of course, buy the good quality canning jars and the two-piece lids. You can reuse the jars, and that's no problem as long as they have no cracks, but you want to buy the new lids, the little inserts, every year just to make sure you have the best seal.
Now, you're talking to people in Wisconsin here, and we'll eat pickled anything. What are some of your favorite non-cucumber things to pickle?
Non-cucumbers. Well, pickled beans. I love my pickled beans. Green beans, yellow beans, black beans. And pickled carrots are really yummy. I actually have a dill pickle carrot recipe, and that one's really easy because, again, you just bring the liquid to a boil, and you cut your carrot sticks, and you put them in the jars, and they're really delicious. and pickled peppers, hot peppers, of course. I don't know, do you eat any hot dogs or sausages out there? Because hot dogs and sausages with pickled peppers are delicious. And then I'm a big chutney fan. So chutney is basically a whole bunch of stuff chopped up and then pickled, and usually some sugar and some vinegar. And peach chutney is probably one of my favorite things. Oh, and salsa. I love salsa.
Maybe a wacky salsa tip to leave us with, because in addition to all the cucumbers, I know the tomatoes are hitting this week.
The tomatoes are hitting, yes. One of the things I like to do, I like to peel my tomatoes before I make my salsa, and I like to hand chop my tomatoes. Some people use a food processor to make it faster, but peeling the tomatoes, it gives it sort of a nicer texture. It's a bit tedious. You'd blanch the tomatoes in hot water and then plunge them into cold water and peel them. And one thing I really like is the plum tomatoes or the Roma tomatoes, because then you can, you don't have to boil the tomato salsa as long, because the big beefsteak tomatoes have a lot of water in them, but you get a more intense flavor if you use the Roma tomatoes.
And for blanching and peeling those tomatoes, I remember back in the day, my favorite piece of kitchen equipment was my tomato shark. It was like a melon baller, but with serrated
yes.
edge. Do you use that?
Look, you know what? I don't have one of those, but I have used them. Yeah, to pluck out the little core.
Yeah.
That, if you still have one, that would come in very handy.
That made a big difference. Wow. Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, thanks for getting in touch, and happy pickling.
That was Jennifer McKenzie, professional home economist. Her book is The Complete Book of Pickling, 250 recipes from pickles and relishes to chutneys and salsas. You can share your favorite pickling, preserving, canning, salsa making stories at the Central Time Facebook page.
And your recipes and pep talks.
Definitely.
For those with small kitchens.
And catch the Joy Cardine Show, too, next Thursday at 6. Joy and our guests are going to talk about canning. You don't miss that.
Yeah. If you want to hear more about preserving the summer harvest, like I said, a Joy Cardine Show is next week. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest from the American Lung Association in Wisconsin about e-cigarettes. We'll also talk about what they are, why they're so popular, and if they help smokers quit.
And we're going to get the science behind sinkholes. We've seen some of those in the news lately. That's coming up Monday on Central Time.